You are listening to Rochester Indie Media. My name is Ted Forsyth. On April 13th, 2013, the Labor Lyceum hosted a panel discussion called Building Worker Power Through Community Organizing. As workers across the nation are struggling with the consequences of job flight, downsizing, discrimination, rampant unemployment, and other labor troubles, a different way of organizing outside of the traditional union model is emerging. Worker centers in more than 80 cities have been founded by communities through grassroots organizing that combine worker community struggles in order to find justice and dignity. Worker centers are comprised of a wide range of occupations that advance a strong worker community-focused agenda, which includes dignity, justice, living wages, and good working conditions, while fighting against wage theft, discrimination, poverty wages, sexual harassment, workers' compensation hassles, and so much more. This is part two, the discussion portion, of April's Labor Lyceum. Moderating the discussion was Linda Donahue. Presenters included Pete Myers of the Tompkins County Workers' Center, located in Ithaca, Caroline Kimti Hani of the Workers' Center of Central New York, located in Syracuse, and Raina Ramalate Hayashi of the Worker Justice Group, located in Rochester. For part one of this discussion, the panel is talking about their specific projects on video. Please see rochester.indymedia, that's indymedia.org, or look through our video channel at indytv.blip.tv, indytv.blip.tv. Thanks for listening to Rochester Indie Media.
Yes, please.
Have you ever approached elected incumbents with the proposition that you are saving them money and time by handling items that they ought to be intimately involved with?
It is always a difficulty when we have laws that are passed by well-intentioned legislators, but they're not given mechanisms to enforce the laws, and to a large extent we have a huge contingent of volunteers. I know certainly in the building trades, I swear if it wasn't for the building trades unions, nobody would ever be identified as being misused at a construction site, but they are really attentive to misclassification issues and other kinds of wage theft. So, it would certainly make sense for the agencies who are responsible for the enforcement to be out there more often doing the investigations.
And definitely to have at least not a hostile attitude towards worker centers. Years ago, actually my first experience with OSHA was I used to go to this this fish fry place that was so full of greasy smoke. And there were these kids working in there, like teenagers, for hours and hours and hours. I mean, and the door has to be open in the winter because it's just like, you know, you go out of there and it's like your coat smells like, you know, fish grease for, you know, the next 2 weeks. I mean, it's good fish, but, you know, obviously there's some issue there. And I didn't know anything about anything. And I just was like, oh, OSHA, yeah, you can call them and stuff. And, you know, and so I called them and I was like, I just think it's really dangerous for these kids. And the person that answered the phone was, like, hostile. They were like, we were just there. I mean, that's not possible. It's like, I have no, you know, axe to grind. I just was buying fish, you know. So that was my first experience. And I know sometimes it's like this attitude of, like, why are you giving us more work, you know? Like, instead of, you know, having, like, a really teamwork or, like, well, thank you for helping us do our work and, like, pointing out really horrible workplaces with violations. So, you know, we're hoping to cultivate relationships with individuals, I think. I don't know, I'd be interested if anyone else has ideas, but, you know, that's what I think is the most feasible, is like finding, well, I can call this, you know, this woman or this person and, you know, get a response.
Yeah.
You could volunteer to do the job for them if they feel that they're pressed for time. Say, okay, how about appointing me a temporary assistant? And that provision ought to be available for free labor. I mean, you'd be an intern and whatnot. And get into their business, which is our business.
Yeah, if only it works that way.
Can I just say really quickly
push for it, it won't work that way.
Go ahead.
We've had actually, before Carolina became coordinator, we've had some collaborations between the Worker Center in Syracuse and our Worker Center. I don't know if you've heard about this, but basically confronting the Department of Labor, the New York State Department of Labor, the Syracuse office, and we're dealing with the same office, and we've had joint meetings with them. And it's, we've had class action situations with restaurants where we're referred to the Department of Labor, and they'll tell all the people that they're contacting through their investigation, don't trust the Worker Center because they're trying to do their job, the Department of Labor's job. Meanwhile, which can take a year and a half. For us, if we had the resources, we'd deal with it in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
What's been your experience in trying to use the mainstream press to try to, get more community knowledge of some of the more egregious abuses? And I was thinking, when Raina mentioned, people from Rochester working on the Sandy cleanup that haven't been paid at all, I would think that would be something that the local newspapers might be willing to highlight, because it's got, it's a little bit different than the, wage theft of one individual, which goes on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess what have been your experiences, and then have you tried to publicize this a little bit?
Yeah, in short, has the press been supportive when you've reached out to them to do, make them aware of these kinds of problems, or do you find that they kind of ignore you as much as the agencies do?
Does someone else want to answer the question first, and then I can...
Yeah, I guess I wanted to the people that have more experience of what's been your experience.
I would say our experience in Ithaca has been really, really good. My guess is, because I think it's more of a, we have Gannett Public, which owns the Ithaca Journal, but overall I would say we get good coverage, and it's more of a smaller town. But I think we get really good coverage. I'd be curious, I don't know how you feel in Syracuse.
I think it's mixed, because I know even from when I was volunteering with detained immigrants, and so I had several people interview me, from even from the college papers to maybe three or four different papers, at least a little segment. And it's just incredible how much stuff they get wrong, and I just, every time it surprises me how inaccurate it is, and that makes me wonder how inaccurate the whole newspaper must be. So, really key facts. So that's one thing, is I'm very wary, and also that many times the workers are scared, and rightfully so. They're very hesitant to be in the paper. There was a case a couple months ago where several janitorial workers, they got together, two of them had not been paid anything, and the other ones had been just bullied and abused, given bounce checks, working, without gloves, cleaning up blood, just all kinds of terrible things. But I felt like I tend to be maybe overly cautious, and when they express hesitancy, I just don't want to push them to come out. And then this Syracuse, the Post Standard is now online for much of the week, and the comments, I know that this is not everybody, but they're so vicious, so evil. And I think that it's traumatic for people who are involved in that to even read these comments.
Yeah.
And, when you're just trying to get somebody's wages, and they're you bunch of Bolsheviks, how is that? I don't get it.
Wow.
It's just, getting paid what the hours that you worked. How is that radical?
Yeah.
So I'm always hesitant to push the workers, and it really has to be their decision, because they have everything to lose. I don't, and the newspaper journalist doesn't, so...
Yeah, that's a really good point. Raina, did you want to comment?
Yeah, so I have these big ideas about, publicizing a lot of the cases that I work on. And I guess the problem is that this legal services model that I'm working in makes it hard. This is why I have so many critiques about the law, is because I have a lot of ethical obligations that I'm restricted by in terms of my practice. You know, I represent the workers, and there's confidentiality issues, and a lot of times what the legal system is really good at is individualizing problems. So we take this problem that could have potentially been the public's problem, and we go into a back room. You know, this one case I'm working on, I've had like 8 negotiations on. Nobody knows about it. It's, you know, 15 workers that were doing asbestos and not getting paid, you know. And so I feel like if I was working with a community organizer who is not bound by a lot of the restrictions that I'm bound by, they could like do the agitating, and if there was a worker center that these workers could go to regularly and become politicized around the conditions that they're working under. And then the legal piece is really just a tactical piece in under those circumstances. And I'm taking direction from workers who have this good understanding. That's where the law and organizing piece comes in and fits really well. And I think that you can do more comprehensive campaigns. You can talk to the media and use all of these different tools. Because I'm limited to the tools that I can use sometimes, it makes it more difficult. But I do definitely try and push people and agitate, but it is complicating once people hand their problem over to encourage them to kind of take it back into their own hands. But with this one asbestos worker case, you know, these guys are like really upset at the legal process and how long it's taking. And I said, you guys can have a picket. I would support you in doing that. You know, I keep trying to push. And sometimes, you know, I think it takes people going through these venues that aren't working for them and losing faith, like, in that process. Like, actually, I don't really believe that this lawyer is going to make my problem go away. I don't really believe that this case is going to make any difference. And that's a long process for people to lose faith in these systems that they think, wow, this is a system of justice. Like, I'm going to get something out of this. And sometimes we have to be patient and meet people where they are and let them go through that. Because sometimes that's what's necessary in order for them to get pissed off and lose enough faith and say, look, I'm done. I'm going to go picket. I'm going to go call the DNC. I'm going to out this and make the confrontation happen in public where everyone can see. It's complicated, but I would love to talk more to people that have ideas. I know there are really great organizers in the room. By no means are we any experts. I know that all of you are really great at what you do, so I'm looking to hear from you too.
I have so many questions I want to pose, but let me ask you first, what mechanism do you use to make workers aware of the services that you offer? Anybody can jump in.
I would say for us, it's because I think on one hand we've learned to use the media really well, and we've had 10 years to do it, but you know, dramatizing situations, you know, I like to think we're going to dramatize something once a month. That might be a bit much, but you know, once every 2 months, like getting some good press around something so people know us. And then the word of mouth, but also something to explore. I don't know to what extent you've explored this, but in Ithaca we have more human service agencies per capita than anywhere in the world. And I kind of joke about that, but I mean, it's there, you know, there may be some truth to it. So we have like a Human Services Coalition listserv with like over 2,000 people on it. And I would say that our workers' rights hotline gets, it's a guesstimate, like 70% of our cases as a result of that. The human services, because these are people that are working with people who are more likely to have their labor rights violated. You know, so figuring out ways to plug into the human services community, you know, that's actually out there helping people.
Do you have like cards that you put out in the community, or that you do hand billing?
Yeah, we have flyers and stuff, but you know, I'm not sure how much people look at that stuff. I guess it feels like it's more word of mouth that it happens. And then you know, people, you know, unfortunately, it's like if it's in the media, oh, this is true, this must be true. You know, so people give like a lot of credence to seeing stuff in the media, which is one reason to kind of. But hearing what Carolina said, of course, you don't like really know what to believe in the first place.
Well, there is that. Then, right. Do people then like look you up in the phone book, or do you have a site that they pass in the neighborhood, or I don't. Do you have a physical location?
We have a physical location. We have a physical location that's like in downtown Ithaca on the Commons, for those who know Ithaca.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I think a lot of people know where we're at. I mean, there's a lot of people that never heard of the Worker Center, so, which is always disturbing because I personally hope that everybody's heard of it. But, you know, and we have a website, and we have a 211. Do you guys, I think every county is required to have a 211 now, and we're very hooked into that. So that's kind of like people calling for information referrals. Mm-hmm. And so if they call and they need help with a workplace situation, then they're going to refer them to us. So,
okay.
Something.
And Caroline, do you have a physical location?
Yes, we have a very tiny office in Plymouth Church. And Plymouth Church is actually, it's in downtown Syracuse, and it's been wonderful about letting us use other spaces. Just actually a couple days ago, we were able to have a large event in the hall there, which was hosting a lunch for the Farm Workers Equality Tour that's traveling around upstate New York to raise awareness about the exclusions that farm workers face, like as far as labor rights. And so that was great. And I think we had maybe about 60 people at that event. So obviously I couldn't have put them in my office. So the church has been wonderful in that way. So, yeah, we do have a very small physical space. But I'm finding, like, when people call, some of them get it from the phone book, get our number from the phone book, word of mouth. We do have a website that's supposed to, I think it's being redone. There was an intern that was working on that. But mostly I've just been posting to Facebook, quite honestly, and I find that works really well. So, you know, we're trying to, I'm trying to become better at even using Facebook because I'm just not great at the computer stuff. So I know that's really important. And I think we should do more. I should do more with a Spanish-speaking radio because I think that some of the farms, like you were mentioning that a lot of people that are referred to you through other human service organizations, but like I think with some of the dairy workers, there isn't anybody that's reaching some of them, and so that's really word of mouth. Like, oh, my cousin, you know, they were able to help my cousin on that farm, so maybe, you know, I'll call them. And so I think that maybe the Spanish-speaking radio would be something that we should look at. And I haven't done anything with that yet, so I need to get on that.
Have churches generally been supportive of the work that you do? Particularly on Spanish community?
I found that churches have been supportive, yes. And I know before I was working, Rebecca and some other folks worked on a Labor in the Pulpit campaign. And so several churches hosted, like I think on different Sundays, some of the workers went and spoke at the service. So yeah, I found that the churches have been generally very supportive.
And Raina, I know most of your work has been through your position at the Empire Justice Center. So the workers' rights organization is really still in the fledgling stage of establishing a presence in the community.
The good thing about that is we have a central intake at our building where all the legal services organizations are co-located. So anytime somebody calls with a work problem, it gets patched to me. So it's not just like a direct line. It's a central line where people have legal problems, and then it gets referred to me. And we've done just like some basic outreach. We went to some festivals last summer and tabled and talked to people. We recently went to one of the public housing projects near the Flying Squirrel and went door to door and talked to lots of people. So yeah, it's kind of ongoing. And when I first came to Rochester, I met with a bunch of the social human services agencies in town, but I think that another listening tour it should be on my schedule so that people know what we're doing and who to call when something happens.
Question here?
Yeah.
Public housing projects. What about access? Getting inside some apartment buildings is not easy.
You
have ways to do that. You know people in there. And the other question I have is about Facebook. The folks that you're talking about, I'm guessing, are not as likely to have a computer as I am. So
actually,
tell me about that.
Yeah, actually, it's really interesting because there's people may not have a computer, but they have a Facebook account, and not obviously not everybody, but. You know, there's like some folks who have like gone back to Guatemala and Mexico, and they, you know, they must have access somewhere to a computer. And younger people are starting to get computers, even in very remote areas or like at a library. And so they'll check in their account every once in a while. So there's actually several people, and also my personal friends on Facebook who are in villages in Mexico and Guatemala. So there's more now, I think, than ever before. And also with phones. I mean, some people have a, you know, internet service on their phone. But yeah, I still think there's not, you're right though. You know, some people are not gonna be able to access either the website or Facebook, certainly. And that's why I think, I'm just thinking now, like, I've got to get on the radio piece of it, because I think that people do listen, you know, listen to the radio in some of these remote locations in upstate New York.
So. I'm really curious to hear about your relationship with the labor movement in your various communities. So, Pete, can you talk a little bit about what your relationship is with the Central Labor Council or the Area Labor Federation or even individual unions?
It's interesting. I mean, I think we have a very... So Ithaca-Tompkins County is... The Labor Council would be Tompkins-Cortland counties. And it's the presence of unions in a smaller... you know, like, I don't actually have an organized labor background myself, but my sense is the presence of organized labor is much smaller in more rural communities than it would be in a bigger city. So I don't even have a sense as to how prevalent organized labor is here. But there's very few labor unions in Ithaca that actually have a home base there. The exception would be the United Auto Workers, which represent 1,500 workers at Cornell, like service workers at Cornell. So we have a very good, you know, it ends up feeling to me like we're more recognized by the public sees us, the worker center, as being more the voice of labor than they do organized labor, because organized labor isn't really out there in the way that we're constantly out there. And I would say we have a really good relationship with them.
Good.
And obviously now we've actually had two situations where one became the local organizing around the Community Action Agency was bid on, if you will, between the United Auto Workers and the painters. And the painters from Buffalo were chosen. And then NYSET was obviously chosen by the charter school. So, you know, it's kind of evolving and growing.
Okay. Do you feel like you have access to Central Labor Council meetings? You know, periodically go in and let them know what you're doing, that kind of thing?
We do. Yeah, we do a Labor Day picnic that's like attended by 500 people, and we do it jointly with the Labor Council.
Oh, great. Nice. Right. Good. Really glad to hear about that. And characters?
We actually, when I had just started back in October, we did a fund drive where we actually reached out to somebody, looked up all the unions within 50 miles, and there was a division on the leadership team. Some people thought it just was not a good use of time to do that, and we didn't get a response from the majority, but we did get some donations. I was really pleased with that. So. And it's something, this is not at all my area of expertise, and some of the folks on the leadership team, I'm trying to learn as much as possible from them, because I would like to understand, there's a lot of things I'm trying to put together. I know as far as undocumented workers, I think that there's a growing sympathy for them and, you know, being able to unionize them among other unions, but I think there's still hesitancy because some people think that, well, they're, you know, taking the jobs from American-born workers and so forth. So so that's something I like one of the local unions, or actually a couple of them have been great with the newly formed Central New York Coalition for Immigration Reform, and the Worker Center is on that coalition. And this is just a couple months ago took off. So And there's some union people in that, so. But yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like there would be support, but maybe we could do more and make connections between organized labor and the services that you offer.
Yeah, I would love that because I like I said, I feel like this is sort of a weak area. I'm trying to learn. There's a professor who's an expert on unions and the leadership team, so I've been talking to him. But yeah, I have a lot to learn about how to sort of navigate this.
Right.
Yeah, I'm still learning too, but I have gotten some warm reception from some key people. A neighbor, Bruce, over here, is here today, and I think that relationship has been mostly informal, just like meeting, strategizing. We've talked about maybe doing like an appeal to some friendly unions in town to see if we can maybe get some funding, get people to kind of understand what we're doing, that we're not like here to compete or something. And I'm hoping that today is kind of the start of that as well. We recently met, and so hoping to continue to build relationships. And what I would like to see is similarly, you know, you have a leadership team where there's some stakeholders around a table figuring this out together, and that's what I would really like to see in Rochester is, you know, even if it's just every couple of months, a leadership team coming together to help me strategize and reach out or to help us do that, because there are other people I think that just have a much deeper relationship, much more nuanced knowledge of how to like navigate some of those tricky relationships. I did a quick presentation at the Labor Council, and I think one of the comments was something about, you know, undocumented workers like taking jobs and stuff. So I think that can get tricky, you know. But in Washington State, where I was, there's actually a wage theft coalition that is really spearheaded by labor there, and the Worker Center is a key part of their efforts to pass legislation at the state level. The Worker Center has passed a local wage theft ordinance that I worked on with them. So there have been like some really successful efforts, and I think that especially in building trades and you know janitorial work, like union members understand that they need to stand shoulder to shoulder with these folks, because if they don't, I mean, you know, it's a race to the bottom. And they have a very, very deep understanding of that. And so I would like for those conversations to happen here, too.
Tom?
When I look at sort of the terrain of worker centers around the country, the ones that seem often the most sort of successful or at least catching some of the most attention are the ones that are either focused in a specific ethnic community or specific industry. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me as though all the ones coming together in upstate New York, that's not really the case here. And I'm wondering sort of why you all think that is and what's driven you to be more of like general worker centers rather than specific focus ones, like I'm thinking Restaurant Opportunity Center, Domestic Workers United, things like that.
Yeah, day laborers. Yeah, there's been a lot of real specificity.
Great question.
Yeah.
I think in bigger cities, it's easier to have like a specialty. Like at Casa Latina, for example, it's mostly like day laborers, janitorial work, construction, and then there was a women's group specifically for women that were doing, immigrant women that were doing childcare and domestic work and reproductive work. Even though it wasn't labeled as that, like a lot of the groups that formed kind of organically were around industry specific or ethnic specific groups. And when I came here, I didn't want to presume that I knew like what industry was gonna work or something. I guess I just noticed that in Tompkins County, it was more like, yeah, whatever came up organically. And because there isn't like an industry that predominates, you know, maybe that works. But I think in larger cities, you're right, like Domestic Workers United, Restaurant Rock, and then specifically like dealing with immigrants, I find like those are like the most common things. But there's also, I think, campaigns that are industry specific that come out of general workers. Like the clean car wash campaign in New York came out of like a bigger workers center. So
anybody else want to address Colin's question?
I think that what I've heard Janice Fine, who's, I just saw, has written a book called Worker Centers. Linda has a copy of it.
I'll pass it around.
She's like, it appears to me, studies worker centers more than anybody. But the vast majority of worker centers are, as you described them, either industry-specific or community-specific. But I think the worker centers that we have and that is kind of developing is actually really important, because I think it like gives everybody a sense that they can be part of the worker center. And it's actually, I had a conversation the other day with the Tompkins County Worker Center is an affiliate of the AFL-CIO's Worker Center affiliate program. So they have a national program where the AFL is attempting to partner with worker centers. And their organizer, a woman named Jennifer Angarita is her name. She's the person in charge of this. She was like, she was acknowledging that, just what you said, most worker centers tend to be more centered in immigrant communities as well. And then I would say that I think our model, because we work with people regardless of where they're coming from, actually helps to normalize, I don't know how to put this, but make all the communities, you know, like I think it brings more respect for the, when we work with people who don't have documentation, just as we work with your average Joe or Jane Schmo from rural Tompkins County, for lack of better ways to put it. Probably not a great way to put it. It's like people are starting to kind of just feel we're all in this together by doing it the way we do it. But I don't think it's an either-or model, because I mean, I can definitely see where there, it makes sense to work with specific communities. So I think both need to happen.
Okay.
Bruce?
Follow-up?
Oh, no, go ahead, Colin. That's a follow-up, so yeah.
Part of the reason I asked the question about like industry-specific is that, you know, my experience within ROC was that there was, with many of the people there, there was very much like a, or at least a faction of folks there who saw a lot of the work of the worker center as being sort of a proto-union in industries that, like, due to horrible NLRB practice are, like, impossible to organize for the traditional unions. And so they're sort of seen as experimental spaces with the intention of developing into unions at some point. And I wonder if in the more generalized spaces that's still part of the vision.
Well, one of the members of the leadership team has this dream of, like, this would be so sort of in the future and the funding would have to come from somewhere, but, like, of having, like, a day laborers co-op, which I think would, because, you know, he studied how exploitative, you know, a lot of these places are, where people will go and be given work for a day and, you know, they're not paid for the time that they're, you know, traveling or waiting or, and that, that these companies are just, you know, making a huge profit, and, you know, off of low-wage workers. So I think, like, that would be kind of related to what you're saying, because you could get, you know, a whole bunch of different workers all doing, you know, obviously they're, a lot of them would be low-wage workers, but they would have some protections. So, you know, that could be like a long-term goal for our worker center.
Bruce, go ahead.
Do any of you follow up to try to build a constituent base out of people that you help? In other words, like, I think it's been around, what, 10 years now? I mean, and you win a case, so people benefit from that. Are you doing any follow-up to build, you know, organizationally build a constituency?
Yeah, I mean, it's so important for us to, and I'm sure for everybody here, to really, you know, get people. We see it as a doorway. We don't want our Workers' Rights Hotline just to be a service. We see it as a doorway to people getting in and organizing, which is not easy to do because the people who are contacting us see it as a service.
Right.
You know, so how do we change that dynamic? But, you know, we've gotten some workers really involved with the Worker Center. Our chair of our board came through a wage theft case. And we have a membership program. So we encourage people to become members, and what that means is you fill out a membership form, and we ask you for 1 hour's wage a year as your dues, or $7.25, which will incrementally go up with the minimum wage. We index it to the minimum wage. You know, and a lot of people aren't able to even afford that, so we encourage people to join. But it's the constant work, and just quickly, let me say, we like to call ourselves a community union. Janice Fine actually writes about community unions as well, and transpose some of the ideas of labor unions onto the community. And the worker base and the consumer base is really important. Both the consumer base is important in this, too. And we have people like who are, in essence, stewards. We have a leadership group called Community Union Organizers, and they're people from the retail and service sector is kind of the workers we tend to focus on. But it's also some amount of the consumer base, a few politicians. You know, it's just kind of like we're all in this together. So kind of following up on the column? Yeah, following up on your idea how we, you know, it's so general, it's not specific, so that makes it harder, but it's kind of seeing that all of our interests are together in this.
Pete, how big is the membership now?
Like 1,500.
You have 1,500 members?
Yeah.
For Bravo.
Yeah.
Right.
That's good. That's very impressive.
Well, it's 10 years, so.
Still, that's impressive.
Yeah, that's very good.
Bill.
What about reversing the roles, which is to say, instead of looking for labor unions to come in and provide resources or whatever, participate in labor actions, such as the postal rally that was held here in Rochester. I don't know if they did them down in Ithaca, Binghamton, or Syracuse, but that way, you know, your folks could mix it up with existing union members and talk, meet people, and see what the power of doing something like it, that is, not just in terms of winning the battle, but just getting right. people excited and hopeful. So.
Question over here.
We do.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I want to second on that. That's a really good idea. I mean, in the course of organizing labor or worker center, I think it's really good to impart with other workers that the example he gave was the postal workers, that what's at stake really for the postal workers, it may not be so obvious immediately, but you have the same stake as they are, even though maybe perhaps that the people that go to the workers' center may be quite much lower pay. But that there is a solidarity, and basically underneath that, that unity is really needed to be able, because really when you talk about I haven't read her book, but I think she talks about the leveling of wages all over the country and the onslaught of big corporation against the workers, organized and unorganized workers. And I think we need to kind of build the bridges all around and to say what you're working for, I'm for it. Because it brings up all the workers all together. It may not seem to look that way in the beginning, but we have a commonality. We have a commonality. And we need to have that solidarity. And you have something going on, we'll try to help you. And we have a struggle, you can help us.
I know that Pete can speak to that because that's how the Worker Center there was formed, through the Living Wage Coalition, and I think their approach has been, in terms of rights enforcement, enforcing the social contract and renegotiating the social contract for all workers, essentially not just through collective bargaining with individual work sites, but kind of renegotiating so that everybody kind of can move up together, and that's been their approach, and they've been really successful at it, and we're kind of studying from their model, and we're working with the Labor Religion Coalition in New York State to hopefully maybe launch something similar here, like a pilot project here, to see if that might work. But I think that's exactly right.
Do I see another hand over here?
I was
go ahead.
Going to wait for Pete to come back.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fine. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is we know that a huge issue, and Caroline referred to this earlier,
this notion that workers really do have everything to lose by making their by complaining about their work situations when they are not represented by a union. It is very easy. In fact, it's almost predictable that they would lose their job for voicing a complaint. And I'm wondering how you address that in your interactions with the workers that you talk to.
I think, first of all, to never like make false promises is really important. Not to say, oh, you know, you're not going to be fired, or even if you're fired, we'll get your job back, or we'll, you know, I mean, because that's just, we don't know. And especially undocumented workers, the ultimate fear, of course, is that they're going to be deported. Mm-hmm. So, and that's just devastating. It can be a life and death situation because many of them have families who depend entirely on those wages, back home. So, they definitely have everything to lose. And I lost my train of thought, but what was the other part
of
your question?
So how do you, in your interactions with the workers, I mean, particularly since the only way to change situations is to come out, really.
Right. I remember what I was going to say was that one positive thing with OSHA was that, for example, in this janitorial situation where there were workers who had to clean up, it was in a clinic, and so there was a lot of, like, blood in the garbage, and sometimes the needles would be, you know, mistakenly, but, you know, people would forget and throw them in the trash. So, you know, people were almost getting stuck by needles, and we were able to file a formal complaint with OSHA, as the worker center, using anonymous, you know, I refer to them as workers A, B, and C. And so that was a big step to be able to do that. And they did an investigation and found violations and fined this company. So that was one way that these workers were protected. That's just that one aspect of the safety at the workplace. But also with the wage theft cases with the State Department of Labor, when we file a complaint, and to emphasize to the caseworker, this worker does not want the former employer to know where he's currently working, because many of those cases, they weren't paid, and then they ended up on a different place, in a different workplace. So, I've had workers ask that many times, like, is he going to find out where I am now? Because then that boss has no reason not to call immigration because they're not even on his farm anymore. So, you know, there's some interest if the worker's still on your farm, because it's like, well, then why are you hiring someone who's undocumented? But in this case, there would be nothing holding back that boss.
Right.
So it's really important. And fortunately, there have been some folks at the State Department of Labor who completely understand that and have been pretty reassuring, although it's just, I can't get this kind of written, like, I can't get this guarantee. I haven't yet been able to get it that, you know, the employer is definitely not going to get that address. I also have used our office as an address. I'll do that whenever I can. When I write a letter to try to get wages back, I'll say, you know, you can send this to this worker at the address of the worker center. And then sometimes they'll be like, well, how do I know you're really going to give it to them? So then I'll get a written statement from the worker, and I scanned it or mailed it to this employer. So there's certain like little tricks, I guess, to helping protect the worker. But it is, we've heard over and over again that especially with undocumented workers, they are, you know, sometimes it's so much easier for them in a way to be like, oh, it's just $500, you know, or it's just, I just won't worry about it. But then, of course, these employers are just so used to doing this.
That's right.
That, like, one of them just said to me, she's like, oh, well, I tell the guys that if they don't give 2 weeks' notice, I don't pay them. You know, like, she just came right out and said that to me. Like, she has no fear. She's been doing it for years, and that's just fine with her. You know, it's been working for her. So.
Yeah, and I think to them, the notion of it not being acceptable just never even enters their mind, because they're so used to calling the shots. The
yes. And so I think it's also important, and I've talked to the workers about that, like, let this person know that that isn't okay, and maybe the next time they're going to hesitate before they, you know, rob somebody of their wages. Maybe.
So. Yeah, no, it's a huge issue, and I don't know. I think a lot of people don't realize that OSHA has a very clear policy of permitting people to anonymously report health and safety hazards. You don't have to give your name, but it really does help to have an advocacy organization that you can go through, like the Worker Justice Center or any of the worker centers that you associate with, because otherwise they have no mechanism for being able to follow up. But you don't have to give your name, and I think a lot of people don't realize that, and it is that fear that prevents people from reporting job hazards right across the various industries. And I know with undocumented workers, it's just like you say, the fear of deportation is so immense.
Yeah. Question.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the documentation issue, have you encountered other forms of blacklisting? Once a worker takes some action somewhere, does the word get passed around among other farmers or employers that this person has to be avoided?
Well, a recent example, there's an American-born hotel worker who actually, it was in Oswego, and she said, if this owner finds out, I'll never work in Oswego again. So, you know, that was certainly her perception. And they were not going to pay her because she didn't return this little plastic name tag, so she was forfeiting her check. So, yeah, it's incredible that, like you're saying, that they can just sort of think that they can get away with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I'd be interested if other people have seen that, the blacklisting.
I feel like, maybe I'm not thinking of something, but I feel like I haven't seen it that much, even with people who have gotten public notoriety through our work. I mean, like, workers don't seem to have a problem getting hired elsewhere. And it's like, just because something is in the media, I get amazed how many people are not exposed to the media at all. You know, so I think I have not seen it a lot.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just wondering if any of you have had opportunity to be in contact with Walmart workers, and I know that some of the organizing in Walmart with the backing of unions and so forth has taken place outside of the regular union.
6 years ago, we had a lot of the work we also do is on living wage issues. And when Walmart opened up in Ithaca for the first time 6 years ago, we had a big year-long campaign, Walmart Pay a Living Wage. And in Ithaca, a place like Ithaca, 25% of the population sees Walmart as the devil incarnate in the first place and are not going to be going there. But there's a lot of people that like Walmart. And we did a pretty intensive campaign for a year, and it felt like there were a lot of people that shop at Walmart that wondered why were we focusing on Walmart. And we didn't get, even though we tried to kind of advertise ourselves to the workers at Walmart, we really didn't get people. And I compare that model to our workers' rights hotline, where people call us from just wherever they're at. And that's very successful. So it feels like that, it makes more, it's not that we should never do a campaign on a very, you know, concrete corporate target, but I wouldn't say it was that successful.
Well, we have one of the members of the leadership team who joined after I was hired, worked for Walmart for 4 years, and she, Tracy Kinney, she published a book about that experience, and she's amazing. So we did do the Black Friday nationwide event. We participated in that, but I did feel this sort of weirdness of being there, and yet I didn't know any of the workers at that store, like, at all. And Tracy, you know, she worked in the Central Square Walmart. So, you know, she didn't know any of the workers there either. So that was sort of interesting and kind of weird because, like, I didn't know how they felt about us, right, you know, pamphleting in their store and, you know, messing up, you know, pamphleting in the bathroom. And, of course, they're going to have to clean it up. And so yeah, I wish that we had been able to connect with them, but we didn't really have a sort of way of getting in there that I could figure out in time anyway. So.
Yeah, and I know you had a question for Pete.
Well, it's not just for Pete, but I guess I want his perspective as well. My question is, to what extent does your work center model rely on volunteers to make it run, and what are some of the benefits and challenges of that?
Good question.
But do you have an answer?
I guess I would like it. It feels like it's a little bit too much reliant upon the staff. It's not that we don't have any volunteers. I mean, off the top of my head, we might have at least 50 volunteers, but it's not. I mean, you can't count on volunteers in the same way because they've got lives other than the work. So it feels like we disproportionately rely on the staff, which doesn't feel like it's the ideal. You know, it feels to build a movement, we need to have increasing amount of people that are volunteers or whatever, member organizers.
Can you tell us what kind of things the volunteers do as opposed to the kinds of things staff do?
Well, with the community union organizers, for example, I mean, this actually is a great model, but I mean, it's kind of like we're, for the service and retail workers and other people that are community union organizers, we basically empower them to help deal with cases. You know, so it's like, I mean, so, which is fantastic. We had this young guy who's a laborer who his friend was not getting paid by a pizzeria and asked me if it was okay if he went to the pizzeria to get the money. And he walked in there. They have business cards. Our community union organizers have business cards from us. And he went in there and got like a $300 check. And, you know, I mean, the idea is if it's just going to be three staff people, we have three staff people doing all the work. I mean, you know, I mean, we're light years away from any sort of real workers' revolution. So we've got to get the workers involved with doing this. So I think those are the volunteers that are really kind of like doing stuff on the ground. Then we have volunteers who do the newsletters and phone calls and stuff like that, more like around fundraising. But that's on an as-needed basis. It feels like it's a model that, for us, still needs worked on, I suppose.
Well, we have a very intense group of volunteers in the leadership team. None of them are paid, and there's a good mix of like from professors to like some low wage workers, and we're trying to get more low wage workers on the leadership team. But they've been fantastic. I couldn't do anything without them, really. So, and also allies in the community, like from the Syracuse Peace Council and, you know, several other organizations and the churches. And that'll be kind of, in some cases, event specific or issue specific, like with immigration, there might be certain people that are great allies that I call on. And then, you know, if there's some specific event, like, you know, a certain group from the church might help. So yeah, that's been great.
You get help from volunteer legal services?
Well, there's two lawyers also on the leadership team. It's a pretty big team at this point. Let's see, Jim Williams is, I can never remember the name of his organization.
It's Legal Services.
Legal Services, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's the director.
Yeah. So he's great.
Okay, so they actually do the legal services that's involved with the advocacy?
Well,
do they just advise you, or do...
Right. They both of them will advise me, and also, like, if there's cases that are very specifically, like, I obviously can't take, like, all these cases, and I don't have the knowledge, so, you know, certain kinds of cases, not wage theft, but I'm trying to think of a good example, but I can't right now, but I would refer to his organization, and...
Okay.
And so they'll call him, and I always say, you know, let me know, you know, because it's not his direct line. So just let me know. Was this addressed? Call back if you need further help. So,
good.
Yeah, and as you know, because you're involved,
speak up a little bit. Please.
As you know, because you're involved with our group, we only have a couple of hardcore volunteers here in Rochester. So we struggle for it to be sustainable, I think, and Metro Justice is actually a fiscal sponsor for a grant that we applied for through the Rochester Area Community Foundation, and we're hoping to maybe get some funding that way. We're also looking at other pools of funding, but it's in the foreseeable future, it's volunteer run.
Please.
I have a very different kind of question. I've been working on the Agricultural Justice Project, which is food justice certification. And we are finally going to be starting in the Northeast. In the fall, we're going to be having a training for the Northeast organic certifiers and any worker organization that would like to participate. Because when farms or food businesses engage in this certification, they have to be inspected both by the certifier and by a worker organization. And so far, we have only been working with farm worker organizations. One of the organizers of this project is CATA, which is the farm worker organizing project in New Jersey. So they have helped develop this project from the beginning. But there is no organization like that in New York. We're hoping that the migrant justice group in Vermont will help us by learning to help inspect exactly those dairy workers that you're talking about. But I would be interested in knowing if you think that either staff people at your worker center or some of the people who are on your volunteer list would be interested in being trained to go to workplaces and do the interviews with workers to help us verify that their employers are meeting the standards of the Agricultural Justice Project.
The first question that comes to mind, I think that's like awesome. And I remember meeting you in October at the Workers Center like group meeting. But I'm just thinking how during an interview, like have you, I'm trying to figure out how to put it. Like, I can imagine a situation where the workers would be afraid to say, yeah, this place really stinks, because if they know that something's at stake for the boss, like, so, do you know what I'm saying? Like, so during an interview, like, oh yeah, no, everything's okay here, because then the boss is going to be angry if it doesn't get the certification. So that just occurred to me now. I'm thinking, that would be so interesting to interview them.
So far, the farms that have gone through the certification are the very best examples of farmers who want to be socially just. So we haven't encountered a case like that. But when workers are interviewed, it's separate from anybody else. It's an individual interview, and they're promised that it will be totally confidential. And when we do the report back to the employer, we generalize in such a way that usually it would be difficult to know which person made a complaint. In so far, that hasn't been a problem. But on the other hand, if an employer were to retaliate against someone from having been interviewed, they would immediately lose this certification. Because this certification is based on only firing people for just cause. And retaliation for bringing up an issue is not just cause.
Well, it's an interesting concept that, one of the things I wanted to ask everybody in the room is how we can work together to support one another. What can the labor movement do to better support worker centers? What can worker centers do to better integrate themselves with local labor movement as well as other community-based organizations? So I'd be interested in hearing any ideas people had for how we can build those kinds of cooperations.
And also, I'm sorry, but I'm just wondering, I know some people who are here, but like, who's who's here.
Well, you're right, actually, because we had a lot of people come in after we started, and ordinarily we would have gone around and identified ourselves. So thank you for mentioning that. I'll reintroduce myself. Linda Donahue. I'm with Cornell University's Labor Relations School. I'm based here in Rochester.
I'm Jeff Nazansky. I'm an attorney at the Monroe County Legal Assistance Center. We're part of Legal Assistance of Western New York, covering 14 counties in Western New York. We've got a background in labor, so I'm very interested about this topic.
I'm Lydia Bayonetta. I'm with the Poor People's Campaign that has been just recently initiated in Baltimore, which will be organizing a march to commemorate Dr. King's 45th anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign in 1968. And we're hoping to organize in Rochester and perhaps hopefully take a lot of people to march to Washington. And, well, that's about it, really.
I'm Gene Clancy. I've been active in the Rochester area, retired teacher and so forth. And I'm also with the Poor People's Campaign.
I'm Jeannie Ward. I'm a member of the Economic Sign Workers Center.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Sorry, I'm a member of the Economic Sign Workers Center.
I'm Brian Acuff. I've worked at the House of Mercy Emergency Shelter in Rochester. Also organized with Take Back the Land Rochester, which is kind of like a parallel to like a worker center for housing issues. As people come, we're fighting foreclosure and other housing rights and human rights violations, and we try to organize grassroots, bring community power around housing, community control around land and housing, and providing affordable housing for people.
My name is Arsenio. I'm involved with Reno's Group, for Justice Group, and previously involved with a number of other labor and community organizing initiatives.
John Garala, I'm with the River Council Education Committee, which sponsors OIC.
Michael Arman, active in Metro Justice, which is a local social justice organization, which is almost 50 years old.
Elizabeth Henderson, I'm an organic farmer on behalf of the Northeast Organic Farming Association. I've been working on this food justice certification since 1999, and we're finally being able to implement it. I also, if anybody's interested, have NOFA's anti-fracking brochures. And the other project that I'm working on with NOFA is helping recruit low-income families to join CSAs, community-supported agriculture, and we have subsidy money to help them offset the price of joining these farms. So if anyone is interested in an application to join a CSA farm at a $100 less price, I have the applications with me.
I'll put these over here on the table. There's some other literature over here people might be interested in picking up. Thank you.
I'm Bill McCoy, and I'm also with Metro Justice. And I might add that we're a peace, civil rights, and economic justice organization that has worked for a long time with labor. And, you know, we clearly recognize our common objectives.
I'm Vincent. I teach at RIT, focus on the sociology of work. So in terms of becoming integrated and forming some ties, excuse me, maybe our local Rochester Worker Center can come into my class and maybe we can get some students to volunteer.
I'm Bruce Popper. I'm a union organizer and vice president of the 1199 SCIU Union, United Healthcare Workers East. I also serve as executive vice president of the 11 county AFL-CIO region here. And I'm on the board of directors of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
My name's Tom Mona. I own a couple businesses here in the city, and I have three young sons in their early 20s, late teens, and I'm just fascinated by the way the labor force market is working now.
John is a current traveling name for me. I have been an occasional attendee at the Occupy Rochester political reform working group.
Ron Linville, past and future member of Metro Justice, member of Rochester Red and Black, and Rochester Indie Media.
I'm Ted Forsyth. I'm also with Rochester Indie Media. I'm taping today's presentation, so if anybody has any concerns about what's being taped, if you want your voice edited out, if you don't want your picture on there, let me know. I can do that. It's all possible. Also, I'm one of the volunteers of the Worker Justice Center in Rochester.
Thank you. John?
Yeah, just as a point of information, I noticed a lot of people were looking at the Janice Fine book and writing a note about it. Not the entire book, but a good chunk of her stuff is online. I can't remember the link or the title, but if you just put Janice Fine Worker Center in your computer, you'll get a link to it.
Oh, and the person that was to my left was Colin O'Malley, yes. President Organizer of Metro Justice.
Thanks.
Organizing Director.
What?
His title is Organizing Director. Sorry.
Is there anyone who didn't sign in today? Because I can send the sheet around again. Anybody not sign in?
I have a question.
Send the subject. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah. I'd be curious to know what the experience has been with your... I understand in Ithaca you've had success with the living wage campaign, organizing some, or getting some 70, 80 different businesses to agree to become certified as a living wage employer. And how effective of a tool has that been to developing your worker center in Ithaca? And would you recommend that as a step that we should pursue here in Rochester?
So right now, in 2006, for those who don't know, we started a program where we certify employers as being living wage employers, which means they pay $11.67 or $12.78 without health insurance. And living wage, we have a local credit union that's very well respected that every 2 years updates its living wage figures. So, you know, obviously, my guess is that Rochester's living wage would be different than Ithaca's. And so we started certified employers, and right now we have 86 employers that are certified living wage employers that represents a little bit over 2,500 workers. And I would say it is really effective for us because, it's like a positive focus on businesses that are doing the right thing. Probably my guess is what you're doing with this, Elizabeth. But it also allows us to say, like, if Autumn leaves used books on the commons, which is where we're located above. We get great rent from. He was one of the first living wage employers. If Autumn leaves can pay a living wage, why can't Barnes & Noble's and Moore's? If Green Star Food Co-op can pay a living wage, why can't Wegmans, P&C, and Tops? You know, it's like, what's up? What's wrong with this picture? You know, and our largest employers, living wage employers, 750 workers. Now that's the county. The city is becoming a living wage employer this July. And the town of Ithaca as well. And I think it's really been a great program.
What about Cornell? Yeah.
Those are their dead bodies. No. They probably pay a good portion of their people living wage, but there's enough temporary people. One of our standards is you can pay somebody the minimum wage in our program up to 3 months. But when you hit 3 months, then you have to pay the living wage. There's a lot of temporary people at Cornell. They're not making a living wage. And, you know, I mean, there are a lot of employers out there that are already living wage employers that for political reasons, you know, because of the field, you know, but for political reasons don't want to be recognized by us, you know, Bolsheviks. You know. And, you know, we don't pose ourselves as Bolsheviks out there, but some people out there think we are. So I think it's been really good. And we actually had this big success 2 years ago where... This is a lesson learned from the Walmart campaign where, you know, where's the corporate target with Walmart? That's in Arkansas, right? Well, so probably everybody's heard of Sodexo, right? Sodexo is a multinational corporation that's based in France, and they do a lot of food service in colleges and universities around the country, including also private prisons, too. Sodexo, Ithaca College claimed it to be a living wage employer plus 50 cents. They never got certification from us, but they were saying they were paying everybody a living wage. Well, what about Sodexo? Sodexo is operating on your campus. And they say, well, that's a private contract. We don't we don't have anything to do with that. I said, come on, because they had used to operate the cafeteria. So we helped to, we had an intern from Ithaca College that we encouraged to kind of like really get involved as a community union organizer in her own community, which was Ithaca College, because that's where she was going to be most effective. And she started this incredible students group and worked with us, doing the, we did the community campaign, and they did the student campaign. It only took us 6 months for Sodexo to cry uncle, basically, and become a living agent.
Well, gosh.
To pay a living agent.
Yeah.
Just in, living wage just in Ithaca, though. Not,
yes.
Not everybody.
Yes. And there are strategic reasons for Sodexo might have been, you know, there were union campaigns, I think SEIU, around the country, and this could look like, this is some good publicity for Sodexo.
Yeah. You said a LaRico lawsuit with them, it's a longer story at the end.
They accused SEIU.
Yeah, no, they. Yeah. This has become a new tool now. It's criminal conspiracy to use normal pressure tactics on the enemy, and
right.
Sodexo used that in SEIU to shut down the international campaign.
You guys were clearly racketeering.
One of my organizers is currently under a RICO civil suit for us going after nursing homes and exposing bad patient care.
Wow.
Yeah, this is going to be the new, watch that one.
Yeah.
New tool.
You put pressure tactics on an employer now, and they're using RICO to come back. And, you know, although they haven't been very successful at the at our level at this point, you got to take it serious. Because there's criminal and there's civil RICO. So we're fighting one right now in U.S. District Court in Hartford with the nursing home chain.
Wow.
But this is one area where very often, I think, community organizations who may not be subject to the RICO in the same way that a union might be, can in an informal alliance or maybe no alliance at all, support and say, extend a secondary boycott or something that they would come down like a ton of bricks on the union for, but the
can't be in the community
organizing.
And it's been done.
It's been done actually here in Rochester many, many years.
Yeah, I think that's part of why worker centers have been so effective, because a lot of the campaigns, I mean, I think union campaigns come out of just worker organizing and the focus being on organizing, but not initially on union recognition. And so worker centers have been able to engage in tactics that unions can't because of all of the restrictions. And so they can get away with more. And when you're working under certain legal frameworks like the Fair Labor Standards Act, that has much more protections against retaliation, stronger protections, I would say, than when you're working through traditional kind of union collective bargaining channels. It just allows for a more diversity of tactics, and it has been successful to not initially look for union recognition, but to fight kind of smaller struggles and then eventually, like in Ithaca, seek recognition that way. And there have, you know, I'm really inspired by attorneys who are doing really creative work with worker centers and coming up with, because it's grassroots driven and ground up driven and it's not litigation driven, and litigation is a tool, really creative settlements. Like I think part of the Hot and Crusty campaign and lots of other smaller shop campaigns in New York City have been filed cases around wage theft, which is under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and these attorneys have been able to get really creative settlements where an employer voluntarily recognizes a union because of the pressure of the litigation and because of the amount of wages owed and double damages and all of these kinds of costs that come with litigation. And so you can use that as a threat to push for more structural change in a workplace and not just get like X amount of dollars, which is, I mean, that's what my work here has been. It's like I get workers money, they sign a confidentiality agreement, and it kind of like dissipates this anger. You know, so from my perspective, traditional lawyering participates in making sure that the status quo stays the same. But I think that there are creative ways where legal tools can be leveraged when it's connected to grassroots organizing, when we're really pushing like creative settlement, lawyers who are thinking strategic, lawyers who think like organizers, but have kind of the legal, technical legal knowledge to make these kinds of creative structural changes. Those are the folks that I'm really inspired by, and I do think there are lots of possibilities. You know, attorneys have gotten injunctions preventing people from being deported based on retaliation. Lawyers have gotten, I mean, there's the U visa, which I'm sure you know about, where workers who are undocumented, who are victims of crimes, can get actual status. It's one of the only ways you can go from being completely undocumented to getting a visa and eventually getting status. If you've been a victim of a crime, and a lot of times there are really horrible abusive practices with undocumented workers, so lots of workers are applying for these visas. But there are all kinds of like legal tools out there that we can use to help support, you know, this kind of work. And I'm learning more every day. I love to work with you all.
Other questions or comments? Bruce?
I guess comment, because I find this discussion really helpful. But I'm increasingly of the view, and now vocalizing it in several places, that collective bargaining just doesn't work anymore. It's, you know, we're in a state of collapse in the labor market. You're in the last bastion of the NYSERD building, the last bastion of the union movement. It was pretty stunning. We had Jeff Kowalski in from Cornell last Saturday. Comes out of the IBEW. And he threw out the statistic, we're not at a state where one out of three union members in the United States belongs to the teachers union. Right? So why are teachers under attack? That's the last major well-financed viable piece of the labor movement, including 1199. Right? So under 6% in the private sector. In our region here, two unions now make up 56% of our membership, NYSERD and CSEA, teachers and civil servants, right? If you add the rest of the public sector to the Rochester Federation, you're at 77% public sector. So, and then, you know, those are the attack lines, attack the postal workers, attack the teachers, CSEA is battling privatization, and all of these county nursing homes, we may lose thousands of members in the next 6 to 9 months, et cetera. And as long as we stay in the NLRB box, that I call it, right, the legal framework that we've been in since 35, we keep losing. Right? Mm-hmm. So there have been four major organizing drives in this town in the last 9 months. All four failed. All were incredibly heavily financed. The Arc of Monroe, the, you know, the premier services for the disabled in this town, spent $404,000 on consultants. That's to crush a little under 400 workers. And it was a close election. That was the other SEIU level, right? So all of that said, I think that the creative stuff, you know, we need a whole new paradigm. We need to stop talking about members. I mean, I'm as guilty as anybody. I keep on doing the same thing. And it's tougher and tougher and tougher. I mean, we fight an incredible, you know, multifaceted organizing thing at the University of Rochester. And we win it after months of fighting and organizing students and faculty and workers, and you guys were out in the picket lines, right? And we keep what we had. We're not advancing, right? We kept our health plan and got a 1.5% wage increase, right? And go back to the table in 12 months. We're now at 6 months, right? You know, Medina, same thing in Orleans County. And now I'm down in Corning. We just settled the falls, right? You know, these are, we're failing to advance economically the standard of living the working class. And unless we do the kind of stuff that you guys are modeling now, reaching all workers, and then building a base. So, Pete, I was really encouraged when you said you had a membership component to this, because that way you're building, and at least you have contact stuff for everything from voter reg to demonstrations and everything else. So I want to get some more info from you, because we got to find a different way of doing this stuff. As long as we still have an office and a budget, you know, labor movement is high, can convert itself. AFL unions have largely abandoned organizing now. I mean, there's maybe, outside the building trades, which have to do it to survive, there's maybe 2.5 unions in this town that are doing any organizing, and the rest of them are all on the defense. So I think this is really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And Randy, the work that you guys are doing, I think, is the cutting edge stuff that we have to be looking at. And I know you're doing it on a shoestring right now, and volunteers, but, you know, again, we have to figure out some way to turn the ship, or we're all dead. We're pretty close to dead now.
Yeah, go ahead, Elizabeth.
The farm worker justice movement has been knocking itself out for 30 years to get the NLRB to include them. And then, you know, I hear about sectors, all the other sectors that are covered, and it's not helping.
My lawyer is now the chair of the NLRB. Mark Pierce is a great guy. You can't get a more labor-friendly NLRB. The NLRB is a cruel joke because people think there's some labor law protection when they organize. And it has been, the NLRA, the act has died the death of a thousand cuts. The case law is so bad, the delays are so bad, and this week the House of Representatives voted to abolish the NLRB because, you know, we don't even know, based on the D.C. Circuit decision of a few weeks ago, which ruled that the case decided in 2012 was illegal because Obama's recess appointments to the board, because the regular appointments were blocked by the Republicans in the Senate, because our friends, the Democrats, believe a majority is 60, not 51. No, that's true. I mean, you know, we got our allies are idiots, right? Maybe we should turn that
out. You edit that out,
but you're right. I mean, I wouldn't spend any effort at all trying to put anybody else under the NLRB. It's just, it's useless, right? There have to be other ways of getting worker power. And if you're under the NLRB, as Gina said, there's a whole, and Raina said, there's a whole lot of other restrictions. You can't secondary boycott, you can't do hot cargo, you can't do this and that. I mean, the key on farm workers, in my opinion, was Chavez's mistake of not making peace with the Teamsters. You want to organize farm workers, you've got to get the warehouses and the trucks. And as soon as you do that, and then you can organize the farm workers. Hawaii did that with the longshoremen, right? They had the docks. And that's why today Hawaii has the highest paid agricultural workers in the world, right? But they didn't organize the farm workers, right? They organized the dock workers. The farm workers joined the dock workers. And the dock workers said the pineapples don't go anywhere until you have a contract. Right? But, you know, I don't.
Well, it really just
gloom and doom, but you know.
Well, no, but it really underscores the importance of us being aware of one another's struggles and trying to find ways to work cooperatively so that we support one another instead of alienating one another by pointing a finger at the so-called undocumented worker who is supposedly stealing our jobs. I mean, that is such a narrow-minded approach and yet is pretty prevalent among certain sectors of the workforce because who are they hearing from? You know, the mainstream media does not support our position, so it behooves us to work more closely together to try to get working people in general to understand who the real enemy is. I mean, we've been talking about it for 200 years. We try, we, you know, take two steps forward, 16 steps backward. So, you know, again, all I can do is emphasize the fact that we need to become aware of what one another is doing and support one another in any way, because without mutual aid, we will, in fact, just be completely dead in the water. And as you say, we are, for all intents and purposes, the labor movement is virtually dead now in the private sector. And that's partly the labor movement's fault. You know, we can't only point to external forces as being responsible for our own demise when a lot of union members themselves don't know what the AFL-CIO even is. So we need to work more cooperatively. And Jeff, did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, I just wanted to, you know, add to what Bruce said, in that I totally agree that, you know, the National Labor Relations Act, it's been all downhill since then. As far as, you know, starting with the McKay Radio decision in 1938, which allowed replacements to take jobs of strikers legally, until and the way the labor movement has built its membership was because it could withhold its labor effectively, collectively. And that has been taken away through a legal process, all done very legally, but nevertheless, it's a dead letter, the labor law. And so until we find better ways to organize, you know, we're stuck with that, but, you know, it doesn't mean we can't change it by working together collectively. And I you know, want to thank our panel for putting their thoughts together and learn more from how you guys are operating in Syracuse and Ithaca, because I think we have enough resources here in Rochester to make it work, and would welcome the ability to work with you on that. A great book on reviving the right to strike is written by Joe Burns. I don't know if any of you have heard of it, Reviving the Right to Strike. He's a former union leader, and I think one of the difficulties is in the fact that the retaliation is a very real thing. Having just prosecuted a wage theft case myself, the process to wait for justice delayed is justice denied. So if somebody has to wait 2 years to get their wages, is very easily discouraged. So we need to find a way around that, and I think mass mobilization is one way to do it. I mean, the idea that you have a worker justice, the hotline in Ithaca you can call, and someone can then get, hopefully become involved in the process, I think is a great model that I'd like to know more about, just what the process is. What happens? Somebody calls and somebody gets back to them. How does that work? Does a volunteer get back to them? Does a staff get back to them? How does that process work, your hotline?
It's all over. It's mostly staff who answer the phone. And, a case could be just we make a referral. That's the lowest level. Or it could be we spend a year and a half with it as they organize a union. So, it's like all over the map, and it's all, our best case scenario in terms of wage theft is, and I would like to get further empowered for us to get to this place, like somebody comes in that's being paid $6 an hour at a clothing store in the Commons, and we get up, down there, and get the money, which we've been able to do, That's fairly rare, but, it's that level of direct action. We've had enough, like public success stories where like, oh, I don't want to fool with them. So, I think it's like every situation is different, but, really provide a base level, and this is so important, we're not the DOL, providing a base level of emotional support to people. That whatever happened to you, just getting their story and listening to it and really being there for them, is so important to it. And we have a place where people can come to physically, so they can call or they can physically come. But just dealing, and never, never presuming that our idea that we throw out around the situation is what works for them. Like, really getting, a dialogue, getting people to take ownership. And really, the concerted action piece, people taking action in concert with each other, is a mantra for us. Most people aren't going to want to start unions, right? Are not able to. But they can take action with one other person, then that changes the dynamic. And they're not really protected by the NLRB, even though the NLRA protects that. But we are the protectors of that. The worker center. It's like in a county where there's no worker center, I would not necessarily recommend that people be much more careful. Not that they wouldn't be careful in our county too, but yeah. It was a long-winded answer to you.
Yeah. Well, it's noon, so any last questions, Ted?
Quickly, I know that people call you and they're like in this place of maybe desperation in Ithaca. And I'm wondering, you talked a little bit about this, and thank you for your answer right there, but how do you direct them into like this empowerment or self-organizing model from the hotline? And then secondly, just off of what you just said, somebody calls you, gives you their story, and you're sort of determining, do we refer them? Do we do like a year and a half long organizing drive with them and create a union? Like, when do you go about publicizing their story to the public? Like, when do you do that? Where is that in the sort of the timeline of events? So I answered two questions.
Good questions. We would definitely publicize without the workers agreeing.
Yeah,
to that.
Yeah, that goes without saying.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just a determination whether this is like a case that would move the public in some way. Is it? I have a journalism background, so it's like, is it a story that we can sell? But the other part of the question would be. We've gotten to the point where we basically, if somebody contacts us, we basically make it very evident to them, this is a membership organization, we would like you to be more involved, would you consider becoming a member? And if it's on the phone, we get their address and send them the stuff. And then we have a little survey that we just started relatively recently. How has this gone for you? The experience with us, how can we make it better? Kind of thing.
I think also just asking them on the phone, do you think, is there anyone else at your workplace that this has happened to? Because sometimes they call and like they haven't really thought about aspect. So,
Yeah, it's really true in discrimination cases and wage theft. There's so many issues that I'm sure you deal with. And one of the things I mentioned, when we pass a sign-up sheet around, we hope that you don't mind being added to the email list of the Worker Justice Center here. And if anybody does have a problem with it, just let us know and we will so note it. And so that we'll share that with the panelists today. John?
A tandem organizing goal could be a legislative initiative to adjust work week length so as to create full employment. Go for a 35-hour work week, a 30-hour week if necessary. So that people be guaranteed not only a living wage per hour, but if we have a shorter work week, that per week, per year, per lifetime, a family has a living wage. And it's, you put those two things together, someone's afraid of decreasing their work week because they don't have a living wage. If you have a living wage, you have no fear. Go, 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 win, win.
Right, right. Good point.
So well, I just want to put a call out to whoever is here. If you know of anyone in the community who is passionate about this work, who wants to throw around ideas, who can make a couple of the phone calls, who knows people with money, who, you know, whatever you guys can think of, I invite you to get on our listserv, to contact us, to come shake my hand afterwards, and, like, let's talk. Because, you know, if this can happen in Syracuse and Ithaca, and there's one that recently has started in Buffalo with a coalition coming together and staffing a 20-hour position in Buffalo, there's no reason that it can't happen here. And I would love to work with you all. We would love to work with you all. So,
well, we've really learned a lot from the three of you. I can't thank you enough for coming here today. Especially those who traveled so far. It's quite an undertaking, and Raina really for organizing this whole thing. So thank you very much, and thank you all.